You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 11th to the 18th of September. My name is John Elms and today I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, books editor Karen Shook and writer Matthew Rice. Scottish independence is filling the column inches this week ahead of the referendum, and that's no exception at THE. Our splash covers an exclusive THE survey of HE staff at Scottish institutions and how they want the referendum to pan out. Simon will be leading off with that one in a few moments. Secondly, when sociologists Richard Arum and Josipa Roxa declared in their 2011 book that American HE should be reformed on account of the fact that students appeared to learn little or nothing in their first 2 years at university, they put a few noses out of joint. This year they're back with a new book which tracks the same cohort of students after their graduation. Matthew spoke to them and he'll fill us in on what they had to say in a short while. And last but by very no means least, Karen will have a comprehensive rundown of our book section, some intriguing works on offer in this week's magazine. But Simon, this news is all over the news. HE Indie Ref survey has thrown up some eyebrow-raising facts, I believe.
It's big news. There's a referendum next week.
If you weren't aware.
In Scotland.
Right.
And yes, they're going to decide whether Scotland should be part of the UK or not. That's the news.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, so THE have done it, its own exclusive poll of academics in Scottish universities. We got more than 1,000 responses. It was done last month, so before the kind of latest sort of excitement over the Yes campaign having a narrow lead in a poll. You know, there should be that caveat, I suppose. But at the same time, you know, very interesting results. Overall, it showed that, this was administrative staff as well as academic staff. Overall, there was kind of a lead for the no vote, people intending to vote no, by 13.6% percentage points. But at the same time, I think when you actually break down the results by disciplines and look at academic staff in certain disciplines, then you get some very interesting kind of talking points, really. I mean, that found that those in science disciplines were much more likely to be intending to vote no than those in the arts and humanities, social sciences and modern foreign languages. Just to give you an example of those sort of differences, a voting intention for those in STEM subjects and clinical disciplines, a no of almost 70% voting intention, and in arts, humanities, social sciences, you're talking about a yes of 56%, so complete turnaround. The other interesting aspect about these results is that we asked a sort of separate question: what do you think is best for universities in Scotland? And there seemed to be more support for a no vote there, really, than for a yes vote. Even when you looked at those who intended to vote yes, there were the majority still said yeah that they thought that was best for university in Scotland, but there were more people that were unsure, really, as well. But we looked at results by university as well, and Glasgow came out as being a hotbed of pro-independence feeling, whereas Dundee was quite low in terms of pro-independence, more pro-union, same with St Andrews and Edinburgh as well. Some of the results might have been influenced by, okay, if we got quite a lot of people from STEM disciplines replying for one university, then I suppose that might have skewed the results of that university. But, you know, that level of responses, it's very interesting to see the kind of the feeling that there is. We got some quotes from people from different sides, or the different campaigning sides, saying what do these results mean, and you know, the pro-union side are sort of saying, well, this shows that the messages we've put across about threats to research funding are kind of hitting home, and that they've actually seen the opinion for against independence sort of hardening within universities, even as generally there's been this kind of seeming surge towards a yes vote. And then at the same time, you've got people from the pro-independence sort of side who are sort of saying, well, you know, this survey was a few weeks ago, we think it's swinging the other way. So, you know, only time will tell generally
how
this kind of plays out with the general population. But you know, it seems that overall the feeling in universities is there's a bit of a fear of what's going to happen to research funding.
One of our respondents said that there's a threat by one of the funders who award grants that they might just cut off their funding to Scotland if it became independent.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of those kind of stories about it. There's an academic who's quoted here as saying they're going to vote yes, saying these scare stories about research funding don't wash with me all my academic life. Basically, as long as I put forward a proposal that's worth funding, I've got funding. There's other funding sources. There's Europe. And you know, the idea that then suddenly all these universities that have got these great academics in are not going to get funding for their research at all. I mean, it's like the currency debate in a way. You know, if suddenly there was a yes vote, you know, things will happen, won't they, that make sure that there is a currency in Scotland. It's not going to be the end of the world. It's not going to be the end of the world.
Of course, of course.
Things will happen. It may be very painful. There may be all sorts of quite serious ramifications, and it's going to be very messy in lots of ways that happens. But the idea that there will be no funding at all is probably, you know, you can see
it's
maybe
not a very rigorous line of argument.
No, exactly. Well, we won't know the result until next week, and with the surge in the yes vote popularity, it's going to be an interesting one, and we will see what happens to Scottish HE after the 18th. From independence in Scotland to students learning in the US, I expect you'll agree with me that that's a seamless transition. Matthew, your feature, what is it focusing on?
Well, this is the book which is the sequel to a book called Academically Adrift, which was a very extensive survey of second-year American college students who were tested on something called the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which looks at generic skills like problem-solving and critical thinking. And the authors argued that basically a lot of students are not learning very much. And it was pretty controversial at the time. And although they very much think that going to college tends to be a good thing in terms of people's earnings over their lifetime, it was taken up by a lot of people who sort of think, well, is college worth it? And of course, if you survey people at the end of their second year, there is that people say, well, okay, they may not have learned much then, but the final 2 years you have much more intensive teaching and seminars and small groups and so on. So basically they continued with a sample of the same cohort and found that the results were still pretty unimpressive. The level of learning, the level of improvement on these generic skills was pretty unspectacular in many cases. And then they said, well, OK, is this just sort of something that only academics care about? And then compared the improvement that people had made on these tests against other obvious, you know, lifestyle things 2 years after college, whether they've got jobs or they're living at home, whether they're financially independent and so on. And what was completely clear is that the people who had improved on these kind of tests were doing much better. Mm. So the lack of improvement is not only some sort of abstract notion that, you know, some theorists of education might care about. It's not delivering the kind of skills which actually people need to really emerge as adults in the normal sense of the word, you know, having reasonably well-paid sort of college-level jobs, being able to leave home. They also look at things like whether they're in, you know, serious intimate relationships and so on. Mm. So it's a pretty bleak picture of what college is actually managing to do for American students.
Absolutely. And I expect this is not just be exclusive to the US. I imagine that, you know, the skills that you learn, the extracurricular skills, as it were, of critical thinking and what is found in university mission statements, analytical reasoning, problem solving, writing, after graduation, that would be important for all students, not just the ones in the US. What are they calling for then, if since their second study has found that it's been their first book was in some ways vindicated. What are they asking for?
Well, I suppose they are in a sense calling for a kind of return to academic rigour. They say, you know, that a lot of things that universities say that they teach students about, you know, understanding difference and tolerance and a sort of kind of therapeutic approach to education. Those things may all be perfectly reasonable things to do in themselves, but they've rather crowded out what they see as the kind of core goals of education. So I suppose they are calling for a return to rather more demanding standards. And one of the interesting things they say is, you know, you ask some of these students whether they're engaged with the academic part of their university life, and then they say, yes, they were. And then you ask them what that actually means. It means that they sort of turned up to most of the lectures and delivered most of the essays they were required to on time. So they're saying that what is considered engagement, good engagement, and indeed gets good marks, is well, the standards are much lower than they think they would like, and they think we should be aiming for.
Yeah, something that was I just described as hoop jumping when I was at university. Matthew's feature is on page 38 of the magazine and well worth a look. Obviously, the study that Professors Aram and Roxer did was quite large, very substantial, and the two books are fascinating. So, well worth checking those out as well. Finally, Karen, what delights from the academic literature world do you have for us this week?
Well, as always, our book section covers new scholarly monographs of note written by academics and reviewed by academics, so peer review, albeit not in the scholarly journal sense. This week, we cover Scott Richard Shaw's book, Planet of the Bugs, Evolution and the Rise of Insects, which our reviewer, Tiffany Taylor, says is an amusing attempt to correct what he sees as the human-centrist bias of evolutionary biology of life on Earth. Amusing, but also well-informed popular science book, as most of the STEM books we cover in the section tend to be aimed at the educated general reader as well as fellow academics. Also this week, what our reviewer Lucy Williams at the University of Kent says is a hugely important work by criminologist Mary Bosworth. It's called Inside Immigration Detention. It's the first real study, aside from Alexandra Hall's work, that analyzes how immigration detention in the UK works from the inside. The focus is on the indefinite nature of the detention, the growing privatization of the sector, and interviews both the detainees and the people who are charged with looking after them. And she notes that the Home Office staff who are based in immigration detention centres have no contact with detainees whatsoever, and the case owners who have the power to decide on the fate of these people are not based in the centres whatsoever. Also this week, historian John Barber, who's an expert on Ukraine, reviews Serhii Plokhii's book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, the dire warnings of Mikhail Gorbachev at the time that the dissolution of the Union could lead to terrible things, the line of argument being that we are seeing some of those terrible things happening now. Sally Munt reviews Jason Weitzel's book, Fat Gay Men, Girth, Mirth, and the Politics of Stigma. This is an ethnographic study about gay subculture in the US, and the academic who wrote this book, Jason Weitzel, has a horror of groups and for some reason decided to take an in-depth ethnographic study. And because he was thin, spent a lot of the time being accused by his research subjects of being a chubby chaser. This week, our Book of the Week author is an extremely eminent feminist literary critic, Sandra Gilbert, Gilbert and Gubar, as anyone who studied literature or gender studies from about 1979, when their book The Mad Woman in the Attic appeared, will know. Tremendously influential scholars. And Gubar, we covered in a Book of the Week review last year. This year, Sandra Gilbert talks not about mad women in the attics, but about food, 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 glorious food. And our reviewer, Shahid Abari, says the book wobbles gelatinously between literary expositions of peaches and recollections of a favoured Parisian food market.
Well, fantastic. Our readers will have their work cut out reading all of those. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's issue review. But as always, you will find comprehensive coverage in the magazine. If you'd like to comment on any of the content of this week's edition, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. Until then, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.